Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host.
CPM4001. Starting with the introduction then?
Nah, don't bother with it.
Don't bother with it? Okay.
No! No, okay. Tip number one for this podcast, do not listen to Magia.
Really?
I just heard some shots being fired.
Recording live from various locations in the world here is the Sester Centennium episode of Polycast. The Mean Team.
Greetings.
Magin.
Morning.
Dan Q.
Marching onward.
Makahula.
Still needs more coffee.
And the guy who cannot pronounce anything properly, CPM4001.
Can we continue on?
I guess.
I don't know. Can we? I mean,
well,
I don't
we know. Could.
It's possible.
But is it a good idea?
It's up to the only woman on the internet.
Yeah, because I haven't heard that joke all week. Thanks, Phil.
Oh, really? How many years have you been doing this?
I just meant that this particular week, you know, the counter resets every Sunday or something, and all week, haven't heard that, and then suddenly...
Resets every Sunday. I'm making a note of this right now. It's a good tip.
No, the weekly counter resets,
me that
not the overall counter.
We need to make this joke during the week as well. The dead horse, it still has, like, pieces of its bones that are intact.
Okay, Phil, no, don't describe the dead.
So we need to pound things a little more.
I just imagine Maggie going out for her daily business that has nothing to do with the show. She's in the grocery store. She gets this twitch. Someone just called the only woman on the internet. I am going to drop somebody. Where are you?
There's like a little kid in the
Where's
shopping
Dan?
Cart. Points over. Look, Ma, it's the only woman on the internet.
This thread from Knight 13117, almost fleet, but not quite. Hidden game mechanic, peacekeeping, in giant quotation marks, and yes, I would emphasize the giant quotation marks, with Civ5's new combat system of one unit per tile, although as an aside, you know, the game's been out almost 6 years. Can we really call it new anymore? But okay. Miraculous discovery. You can completely neuter an enemy's war effort against your friend by simply standing in the way.
Neuter people? I like it.
I don't like it. Not just neuter, completely
no.
neuter. So there are different stages of neutering. Now, it's true, Mackie. It's been said on the internet,
right,
so it must be true.
Join my game. I mean,
Didn't we already have this partially tested out with somebody doing missionary spam around someone's city during Turncast?
It may have come up in a Turncast special in the last
time. I think it's come up in Turncast a few times for different sources.
The Knight was playing Shoshone with the freedom ideology, and the only other civ sharing his ideology was Egypt. Assyria, by now an empire of 5 cities and possessing a strong military, decided to take Egypt's 3 cities for itself, which have led it to become the most powerful nation in the world. I didn't want to lose my Egyptian friends, and I really didn't want Assyria to gain any more territory than it already had. However, Assyria was an important trading partner for me, and I didn't have the resources to invest in a long war. Moreover, I didn't want to increase my status as a warmonger by making a declaration of war against Assyria. So what did I do? I became a peacekeeper. I sent 6 tanks south, each one guarding 1 hex around Heliopolis, the Egyptian city closest to the Assyrian border. The Assyrian artillery pounded at Heliopolis, reducing it to 0 health turn after turn. But with my 6 tanks blocking all entrances to the city, there was no way for Assyria to claim its prize. Moreover, the 6 tiles I guarded couldn't be pillaged, ensuring the citizens of Heliopolis didn't starve to death. Assyria was so intent on taking Heliopolis that very little of its forces made their way to the Egyptian capital, Thebes, which defended itself quite nicely. In the end, Assyria managed to destroy the Egyptian city of Memphis, but with the 2 larger cities remained in firm Egyptian control. What could have been a major upset to the world balance of power became a minor diplomatic incident thanks to my intervention. Minor diplomatic incident?
He lost a city. That's not minor.
Yeah.
Have you ever played this way in a Civ 5 game? No, and I ban you from doing it ever again.
No, that's great.
Yep.
I'm kidding. Totally.
I'm going to start a game just to have that happen just so I can mess with the other empire.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it a mechanic, though. I would say it's a tactic. And I don't think it's hidden.
I think I've used this slightly. Not nearly as spammy. But, yeah.
Game says if you're going to go for that sort of blockage, then pick out cheap, easy-to-move units like scouts.
Yeah. I seem to remember using it maybe once, not to block cities off, but to block like a mountain pass or something with a scout. It was kind of completely pointless.
Yeah,
or
it has a lot of early game utility if you're in a more competitive environment. You're trying to beat somebody to a city spot, and you have units like scouts that can move through rough terrain easily, whereas the settler cannot. You can pretty well box their sorry butts forever from advancing in that direction unless they declare on you, which isn't easy to dislodge necessarily with early game units. If they're really trying to kick out a settler fast, you can pretty well wall somebody out of settling near you.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you think about earlier game, all of those big, nasty early game empires that will just roll somebody with mass units, yeah, if you want to have a border between you and them, you know, six scouts will surround somebody's capital if they let you, and then the other AI won't declare war on you because they're too far away
sometimes.
Sometimes, or they have a better target at the moment. And then, yeah, you could just sit back and make sure that that evil horde of nastiness stays a nice safe distance away.
Of course, you do have to pay for those six units.
Well, pay for the six units or deal with a snowball rolling.
You actually need your target to have open borders available in time before they die.
Yeah, that too.
That's still, it has some utility there, absolutely.
But yeah, mountain passes, stuff like that, if you can get in between them, then just fill it up with units so that they can't skip over you. Especially good with forests and hills.
Oh, I got it. That's what you do. If you are the person trying to take the city that is being protected by somebody else, wait for the open borders to come to an end.
That's a long wait, especially at quick speed. Jeez.
Well, patience is a virtue. You just hold back and you wait.
Yeah, but every turn in the game is costly if you are delaying the entire point of you declaring war in the first place by somewhere between 10 to 20 turns to wait for that open borders agreement, and that's really costly. It's not a cost you observe directly, but your opportunity cost is immense.
If it's going to be the capital, and you're trying to quote-unquote formally win the game, then it may be worth your while. But they're not even talking about the capital here, as a matter of fact. So I wouldn't do it in that case, because then what's the point? Fine, you protect that one city, I'll go and take out all of the other cities, and we'll see how really good of a friend they actually happen to be. While you commit resources to protecting that one city, you're still gaining strength, and I'm in a better position to be able to go after you now.
Sometimes you can't really get units around like that, though.
Yeah, they usually get in the way and cause trouble.
Single file, you get your units wiped out as they're trying to get to the next city because they're stuck going single file or doing really circuitous routes. It's annoying.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend nukes because if somebody wants to surround your target city with units, well, those units aren't going to do a whole lot when they're nuked. But that's late game stuff.
I was going to suggest nukes too, certainly. That's just the fallback. You know, if something's not working, just blow it up.
Yeah, nukes are pretty much the way to go in general.
Another thing you could do is if your borders are pressing right on the other borders, and you're talking about land tiles, you could citadel bomb it. All you need is one. All you need to be able is to eject that one unit that is on that tile that's preventing you from taking that city. If it's really that important to take that city, which given the description here, I'm not certain it was, other than to simply say that you could. But if it's a capital and you're trying to go for that domination victory, to quote-unquote formally win the game, then yes, then it would be worth it. I think it is a smart tactic, because by protecting that other city of that other empire from being taken, even though it kind of comes up in the thread, you know, you really should get a diplomatic bonus for that, having the AI recognize that that's what you're doing. Wow. Well, I think just you realizing what it is that you are doing.
My troops are just passing through, man.
Go my knees.
Record of our episode 247 with Dan Q, Akalua, the Mian team, Mad Jin, and Grimbeck.
Steve, beyond Earth, rising tides. Oh, well, actually, speaking about what may come after rising tides, we have some discussion of what people would like in a second expansion.
Already called Ernie, so, you know,
I was about to say yes, we're talking about Ernie today.
Yes, sir. Bert and Ernie. Very original.
Yes, the hopeful acronym for a second expansion pack for Civilization Beyond Earth, if and when there is one.
It's definitely catching. One of our previous guests has it in the title, and then people are understanding the reference.
Yeah.
It's always fun to start fires.
ZCZRish, who was an episode on 237 last September, started this thread. He's looking to make a video discussing his hopes for Ernie. The format that he suggested, I like this. The suggestion, further explanation, potential positives, and potential negatives of your suggestion, looking for as well thought out suggestions as possible. For me, and I think some of the suggestions reflect what we've already discussed in terms of what would make Civilization Beyond Earth better. Like Kip Wheeler and Defiant Mars are talking about hybrid affinities, whether it's the case of Kip Wheeler, who is looking for some more aesthetics to go along with that. Defiant Mars, also looking for some aesthetics as well. And actually, it's a lot of aesthetics and terminology, which is kind of supplemental to other concerns about hybrid affinities, which is, so, those hybrid affinity units, they're pretty nice, but very situational. It's just kind of nice often to build one just because you can. Supremacy King 2, though. Add one, maybe even two more rings on the outside of the tech web. Also, add tech eras. Adding more text is self-explanatory. Tech eras would be similar to the ages in Civilization 5. Certain text in a given ring would be prerequisites for a certain era. Each era would grant the player a special bonus. You would add more outer rings. You place the victory conditions on the outer rings, make the game longer, and let players experience more sci-fi stuff before reaching the victory stage. You add even more crazy sci-fi stuff in the end to make the game more interesting, and this would encourage players to complete more of a ring rather than just beelining down a certain branch in the tech web. But he sees the cons as implementing this idea would require time and effort and balance consideration as well. To me, I don't think we need or even want more rings. We just need to move around certain things, i.e. those technologies that give you affinity points, combined with getting more affinity points from things other than going down the technology web like we've talked about before, such as quest completion.
And the demographic screen. We want a demographic screen.
Yes, we need to know who's first and everything.
I definitely agree with improved stations suggested of Supremacy King. Yeah, we know the stations are pretty basic. They just give you extra yields when you trade. I think they should contribute more to gameplay. I propose making them more like One City Civs. Oh, like these things called City States that were in Civilization 5, maybe? Gosh.
No, don't do it.
Don't do it. No, really. Don't do it. They're annoying enough as it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're useful and annoying simultaneously.
Is there potential game depth by making stations do more than just sit there and get whacked because they're in the wrong spot? Yep. So there's you know, plenty you can do on that.
Yeah, I don't actually tend to whack them that much since Rising Tide, since they only they reduce the radius of where you can put your city.
Yeah.
Stations.
And if they place themselves in a certain spot and block you from accessing certain parts of the map, i.e. there's this one hex water connection here in the southern portion of the map, okay, you're probably going bye-bye. But otherwise, yeah, you're ignored, which isn't in of itself a problem.
Yeah, it's like now that the water is eligible for more city spots, then they'll spawn out there and not necessarily in your way.
Yeah, they're slightly less annoying than before.
I wouldn't want to see them be city-states, but I would like to see them more like city-states.
With more interactions.
They're pretty bland.
Yeah.
It's like,
here's
like
a place to send your trailer for free stuff.
It's like the orbital layer. That's not much to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'd like to see changes to the orbital layer before stations, actually.
Yeah, because most of our multiplayer games, unless we get free solar collectors out of the resource pod, I don't think anybody bothers with orbital.
Well, the satellite that allow you to teleport some units is kind of useful.
Yeah,
but it's down a tech path.
It's very rare.
Exactly.
Unless you go there, you really don't go anywhere near it.
I'm trying to give orbital layer some positivity by trying to say, oh, well, if in our multiplayer games we are more about competing against each other as opposed to being cooperative, but even then, actually, no.
Yeah. I remember when D first came out, people talked about, oh, rush for solar collectors or other such things.
Well, yeah. The idea of those shooting satellites, fun to think about, and like a planet-busting type thing, just blasting cities to pieces and stuff. But
you do have satellites that can attack.
I know, but in practice it just wasn't that good. It wasn't worth getting. But it was a cool-sounding concept initially.
Yeah,
and then it gets shot down by like random garbage. Or you can just kill all the cities you want to kill anyway with any number of things you can reach more quickly. Even planes are better. That would be my suggestion, by the way, is to make air combat fleshed out at all.
Pretty much completely ignore it.
Yeah.
Not suffer that much.
Right now, if you stack a decent number of planes, you can take cities with just planes. It's not that hard to do. The problem with them is like they're generic. It's so generic. You just build a couple planes and that's it. That's the extent of the strategy.
There's the artifact power for planes, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, even without it, though, like, I was encountering routine situations where I was putting, like, 6 planes on a city, and I'd be able to take it, like, that would flatten the city's hit points to nothing. You could often get those 6 planes anywhere.
I like the artifact. I don't know what they could do to make it better.
Yeah, it's
maybe
pretty good.
Balance? Maybe balancing it, but aside from that, mechanically, I don't think that's where the game needs the help.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Diplomacy still needs some help, so you can work on that more in the expansions.
It's actually functional.
Yeah.
You still can't really bribe the eyes.
It's introduced more limitations than I would like. Here's what you have in Brazil. It's kind of like Chaka. It's like between Chaka and Monty, literally.
Mm-hmm. The only way to bribe the eyes is to ally them and attack someone else. That way they're forced to declare war. But it's just clumsy.
Hey, wait, K-Mad? Is this our K-Mad or is it a different K-Mad?
I think it's a different K-Mad, Kanji.
Okay.
Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, well. The fake K-Mad had the Civ 6 idea.
Oh!
It's not the K-Mad we know, okay?
Oh, wow.
Anyway, Civ 6 idea, city experience. That cities would get experience when they kill enemy units, just like units do. They should be able to get upgrades in the same way, too, with options for upgrades, such as an increase in hit points or an increase in range or an increase in bombardment power. You know, they want to know, what would the downsides be? Will the range increase? I don't want the enemy cities to get a range increase.
Yeah. Their defenses in Civ 5 are strong enough already. Now, in Civ 6, if you completely change
the
combat model again, then maybe it would be appropriate. But if you are talking about the framework of Civ 5, its unit model and XP model, no frickin' way would that be a good thing for the game. If anything, cities need to be nerfed, not buffed. But if we're talking Civ 6, maybe? If it's completely different again, then whatever.
Yeah, well, the increase in hit points is already implemented within Civ 5 because as tech goes up, the city gets stronger.
But you're not doing that from experience. You're doing that from growing your city from tech and buildings.
Buildings.
Yeah. So maybe an anti-barb bonus.
And troll mode ideologies and wonders, too, for that matter. But 200 strength city for the win.
I don't know. Like, gaining experience, like right now, I consider that to be the equivalent of I just constructed walls in a city.
Yeah, that's experience. Yeah.
So do you want to say, okay, you're not going to construct walls as a building anymore, which is kind of humorous. It's a building that's, you know, surrounds the entire city. But if you're going to take that out and then say you kind of abstract that as based on actual combat with other units, you realize, oh, we need to be able to improve our walls. And by going through these battles and realizing that what we have doesn't work, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, so we have to improve our walls. Therefore, our promotion is better walls that then translates into better experience. I could see that.
Yeah, it could maybe work.
Yeah, but you'd have to nerf everything.
During top post in the thread is Legacy, pointing out that this is rewarding players for reactive behavior. Other people choose to attack you, so you get a bonus and punishes the proactive behavior. If I attack and he holds, I just gave him a bunch of free stuff.
Uh-huh. Totally agree with that. Anything that you get for somebody else coming to you seems questionable at best.
Yeah.
I mean, you can already get a lot of stuff from people coming to you anyway. Defense does not need to be stronger in Civ 5.
Well, it's just a reward factor, I guess, more on this side. Like, why are you getting rewarded for being packed?
Well, you can do that with, like, the Honor Finisher, for example, or Aztec UA or whatever.
Yeah, but those you get even if you do attack. Like, if you're the attacker, you still get those.
That's true. But we're just comparing city versus other combat stuff.
Yeah, that's where I look at Legacy's post a little bit further down. If you're the one attacking, how does it change your decision? If you fail to take the city, screw it anyways, since your strategy can't possibly involve slamming units into their city and then not taking their city anyways, so it probably doesn't affect your decision if you're the attacker. If you're the defender, at what point did you make decision? The attacker chose to attack, this has nothing to do with you. You chose to hold the city? Not really. It just kept doing it. When will you ever be, I wasn't going to defend the city at first, but then I realized it would get XP, so I'm going to defend it now.
Yeah.
I kind of agree with that line of thought. You're not making a decision to defend your city. You have to defend it. So why should you get experience towards the city for defending it? When there's stuff like buildings and other things. Because I'm pretty sure in history people didn't go, hey, you know what? We're getting attacked by these Mongols. We're doing okay. We're defending. But you know what we need? Walls. We should learn to fight and then go, you know, wow, walls would have been helpful a while ago.
We should get those now.
I agree. It would be odd that the only time that you would then get walls would be after being attacked. You might want to be, as was being said by Legacy, proactive towards that. Gavin Zach said, not experience, but perhaps some sort of morale or culture. A real-life city that repelled or survived an attack would get pride from doing so and remember its victory for a long time. Well,
that's slightly different.
Yeah.
That makes more sense. That could also work within Civ 5.
Even in Civ 5, you could possibly already get that. If you have big battles near your city, then you're likely to get artifacts there. You already get rewarded for defending the city in a roundabout way. And that's related to culture and long-term vision of memory of what happened.
I think the number one incentive for defending a city is that you keep the city.
Don't want to lose it?
Yeah. You know, the point of attacking you can keep the city. Like, you know.
I guess this is kind of a roundabout way to try to help the Goddess of Protection pantheon.
What? Dan?
Well, let's try. You know, if cities can gain experience, well, let's get a leg up on experience before waiting to be attacked. I'll just adopt the pantheon that gives my city greater bombard strength, so therefore I can be proactive
all
in
right,
that
that's
sense.
It. I'm going to found Condorism and take that.
Yep.
First.
The worst Condorism ever.
Yeah, and then I'll just take all the stuff that you get, like, faith from spreading the religion more. And then I'll get, like, cheaper missionaries, and I'll just keep using the faith I get to make more missionaries, and the whole world will have to live with that garbage.
Yep.
It'll be my singular mission. Here, Dan, have Condorism.
I love inspiring Visceral on a Saturday afternoon.
Me too. We have a response back from episode 244 from Mega Bears fan. My only point of contention with this basically is that it's long enough ago now that I don't even remember exactly what I said. So I've kind of had to infer it from reading through his response, but also our listening audience, including our live audience, probably doesn't have that, like, locked iron in their minds either.
Way to assume, Phil.
Well, you know how I put the emphasis in that word anyway, Dan, so nicely done. With that being in mind, he has a couple of responses based on his suggestions that we covered in episode 244.
The overarching theme, empire management design philosophy.
For a Civilization VI.
Yes. City sieges, talking about the possibility of them being damaged versus destroyed outright while being bombarded. I don't remember what I said back in the day when we did this, but that is, it's kind of like getting pillaged, but inside your city.
Yeah.
He's talking about a cost-benefit between length of siege and losses you're willing to take to your own forces, but, I mean, really, you don't want to have a city under siege in the first place, because that implies your tiles are being pillaged and your units that were in front of the city are compromised in some way, or you're just horribly out of position. I'm not convinced that this needs to be... Well, of course it doesn't need to be, but that this would improve the strategy aspect of it. Like, you already don't want to be caught out to the extent that you have people able to hit your city significantly. That's already a bad position to be in.
Well, this is more from the attacker's perspective, I think. It's the concern of if things can be damaged when you drop bombs on them or other such things, then it's the question of do you do it the slower way but less damaging, or do you nuke it from orbit and then pick up whatever pieces happen to be left.
So unless people cannot get rid of their buildings themselves, you're not going to capture a city with buildings.
Well, even in Civ 5, you can only sell one building per turn. So.
Yeah, but if it looks like you're going to lose the city, I mean, I guess you could blitz it. Between those buildings you lose on capture and the tendency to sell, it's already a situation where you're unlikely to get a lot of useful infrastructure in a city you capture. You might, but you probably won't.
Well, I'm guessing he also assumes that the auto-deletion of X type of building might not exist anymore.
Yeah. I just don't see this as a strong strategic dynamic in most cases.
It's more subtle.
Yeah. It wouldn't, like, massacre the game. It probably wouldn't change gameplay a whole lot. But, I mean, I don't have a problem with it, I guess.
It makes me think, actually, a little bit of the, air quotes, peacekeeping topic we already addressed.
He next mentions the dead-end techs and also made a comparison to both the Civ 4, like stuff like liberalism. I think Divine Right's an even better example. He's comparing them to Leaf techs from Beyond Earth, so that there's some benefit to getting there early, but not necessarily later.
Some dead-end techs are probably fine, but whatever.
Have like a risk-reward type of thing. Like, it's a little bit better than following the standard path, but you have a risk that if someone beats you there, then you've committed resources to something that's actually giving you less benefit. Yeah, that's okay.
Or something.
I mean, Civ's done it to some degree all along. And I guess less so with Civ 5's tech tree, but you still have the Wonders there, for example.
Yeah. There's still a Wonders tech in Civ 5 that is in main path.
Okay, his next point of contention here is climate change. And, man, I'm just going to take like a sentence out of this. Like, if a mini ice age starts, you would have some indicator that temperatures are falling and winters are becoming harsher, so you'd have some buffer period in which to try to take action. Now, my line of thought here and my issue with climate change in general in these games is what exactly actions are you going to take within the framework of the gameplay? Exactly. What would that look like? I can't picture it from a Civ 4 or Civ 5 perspective at all, really. How are you going to prepare for this that's going to have a meaningful choice to make in gameplay without changing the scale of the game? That's the biggest problem with these weather effects, is that if you're just having random event crap like Civ 4 implemented, it really doesn't add anything to the game. But if you know it's coming and can't do anything about it, and it doesn't change your decision-making framework in any significant capacity, it's not adding anything. So what are you doing to offset this ice age? And what are you, like, how are you making choices about it that gives you an advantage compared to other players who don't handle it as well? That's what I want to see, and I can't picture it while still having it plausibly be called climate change as opposed to some other mechanic.
Mega Bears fan says, I was not suggesting random weather events. I was talking about the game having a climate model that would cause gradual changes over time that have the subtle effects on the flow of the game.
That sounds good, but what does that look like?
My issue with that is less about what is the event, what is the scale, what is your ability to respond to it, but what came before that? If it's not just a random weather event, now, whether this ties into realism or not, again, this is more about certainly gameplay consideration. Something that you did or didn't do, whether or not this is also fun is also another question. But it could be something in terms of, could be, for example, you are over farming. Then you're taking the risk of, okay, I'm really going to tax this land that I have to the extreme because I've only got 5 grassland hexes. And I want to be able to push the production of the food on that so I can act like I actually have 6 or 7. At some point, there's the possibility that that system is going to collapse and there's going to be a drop in terms of food that you are able to get within the city itself. So then how are you going to compensate for that? Are you going to allow the city to starve? Are you going to try to get food imported from, like through a trade route, another city in your empire? Are you going to try to get food imported from another civilization altogether? That could work so long as I could say not only is this event that I'm presented with, there's something that I can do to mitigate it, but there was something that was going on before that particular point in time that I could look back and say, you know, that was a risk. I took advantage of that, and now I'm having to pay the consequence, which may or may not happen, but that was reasonably going to happen given how extreme things that I was doing with the farming and over the length of time that I did it.
Here's the issue with mechanics like that. It reminds me of Civ 4 slavery and the event that gives you unhappiness from it that can just hit at any time. The slavery in Civ 4 was so overwhelmingly favorable in the vast majority of starts that it was a false choice. It was strictly poor play to skip it as a civic. However, you could be punished or not punished randomly for making what is still, regardless of whether or not you're significantly punished for it, the superior choice. And to me, that doesn't feel like something where the player's success is being accurately represented by his choices. At that point, somebody can be very significantly hindered for making the same choice all the other players made, and just the game decided that, hey, screw you this time. That doesn't really add anything to the experience in my mind. And the climate stuff has that risk as well. okay, I mean, we had like a little ice age a few hundred years back that probably did not have much to do with human intervention, since our technology at that time wasn't at a level where we could just impact the global scale that much. And you can have something like that in the game, but again, we have like somewhere between 40 and 1 year periods between turns. That's going to come and go pretty quickly, relatively speaking. So yeah. What does that look like as a gameplay mechanic, and how do your choices really matter here? Are you going to make the same choice regardless and you're just randomly punished for it? Or is it something that's so marginal that your choices regarding it barely matter? To me, it's almost outside the bounds of core gameplay at the scale that Civ operates.
Yeah, a tightening up of turn years would matter for a lot of that stuff. And yes, there was a mini Ice Age, and yes, it had some minor adjustment to people's, but in the grand scheme of things, it really didn't do anything.
And that's worth pointing out, too. Like, we know that Great Britain conquering a bunch of the world, or the Mongols conquering a bunch of the world, or Rome conquering a bunch of the world, whatever. Those are historical events we remember, and we can even, as relatively late people, think about some of the impacts of that happening. What did that little ice age do exactly to a random nation in, say, Portugal or Central Asia or Egypt? What did that look like in each of those places respectively? And what choices did the nations historically make to offset the implications of that little ice age? Like, does anybody know that offhand? Maybe one person, but still.
I'm pretty sure none of them knew about it. It would have been a northern thing only, really, because it would have got colder and less food and yada, yada, yada. And some migration probably happened away from the north, and or possibly a war or two over food stock or freshwater supply, stuff like that. But it would have been more localized up north.
Exactly, which is what I was getting at with my example.
That's a significant problem unto itself as well. Yeah. How do you represent that in a game that doesn't screw up the game's balance further? Because the last thing you need is with a friggin' tundra start is to get a little ice age screwing over your food supply. Why even put a sieve there in the first place? Maybe when I was making my sieve, I didn't want to start in the tundra.
Yeah. To go along with Dan's slightly different, not climate change model, more of
resource
land. Yeah, land usage model. I mean, that we could probably come in with something without people getting too bitchy about progressive silliness. Because it is clear that if you mass farm an area for a very long period of time, it will lose fertility. That is clear. It's just been done. Yeah. If you mass mine a hill, eventually you take all the stuff out of that hill, and it's not really hilly anymore.
Well, usually there's not enough of the metal you're looking for, but you do run out of useful resources to mine from that hill, and then it's just a hill with nothing.
Yeah, or maybe you blew up the hill because now you wanted more land for building stuff.
Maybe, but that won't happen for most of the game's time period.
Yeah. No, well, actually, there are big mines that are currently under the city in London and stuff like that that used to be big hill mines, and they all just disappeared because they all get massively dug out, like gold.
That, and also, we know there are more resources right there, but given our current level of technology, it's not economical for us to be able to extract that in usable quantities. Maybe just even mining a hill, for example, if you improve that early on, then at some point it's okay in order to maintain that particular production on the hill and recognition of, you know, you've been mining this hill for a while. At some point while you're going down the research path, you want to pick up this particular technology. So at this particular point in time, you know, your mine doesn't go from, say, four hammers down to three, but then you pick up that particular technology. That's reflective of the fact we have improved our mining operation so that we can now get to that additional resource, abstracted lowercase I here, not a strategic resource, although you could do that with that as well, in order to be able to continue to get that production as time goes on. But again, like with the farming thing, it is very localized, and it's specific to that city or cities within your empire that applies to. But it also wouldn't be a substantial degree that, number one, it would cripple you, even temporarily, let alone anyone else in the greater wide world knowing what's going on, or quite frankly, even caring.
Hmm. Or you could blow it up, too. Like, if you're actually pillaging, maybe you pillage the gold pile and you get a bunch of gold out of it, and then there's less gold there to be mined later. So maybe all land improvements have, say, a 100 points worth of turns, like 1 point per turn, worth of stuff that they can use from it before it has to either get changed to something else. Say if it was farmed, you can switch it off to something that's not farming for a while and not waste the fertility. Or if it's a mine, before that resource specifically on that mine goes away. You probably need more resources in the overall game map because, well, eventually you dig everything out. But yeah.
Would you mind giving this hell a little rest for a little? Yeah.
You can definitely have some balance with that.
Yeah.
I mean, like how you use your tiles.
As long as it's not the degree of, you know, saltpeter from Civ 3.
Oh, God.
You can't mill your units anymore. On that note, we're going to move on here on this response. Resource markets. Okay. I don't mind the idea of resource markets, but I want to first see an AI that can value resources plausibly in,
yeah,
within the context of just the gameplay. You know, horse for 2 gold per turn, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. The market value should be determined by resources the Civ knows are available, but right now it can't determine market value on any basis whatsoever, aside from just a fixed value that's set. The AI is quite bad with this. If Civ 6 AI is better, then okay.
All that takes is writing a small chunk of code that replaces that set value with a calculated value. That is not exactly a hard thing to do. It's not about the AI, it's just...
It's not hard to write that code, but it's hard to write that code in a way that the implementation in the game is not going to look nonsensical in at least some contexts.
Oh, why am I thinking of black markets? And,
so everybody hates Montezuma, so I can sell him this iron for like 10 times the price. And you're going to get players who will engineer situations where a given resource is scarce to the AI and then just take all the DDA AI gold. And then their income is going to be like DDA AI income, like really fast.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's better for the game outright.
Well,
if you're like operating on a different scale, you have like a pricing model of commodities or something that you have to consider. Okay, but that's not what we're seeing from Civ 5 as feasible. Now, could it be in Civ 6? Yes.
But I think part of his point is don't go based on global resource, especially if there's not a bunch of those global resources being utilized.
Well, that I agree with. I mean, there's no reason to count things that nobody has.
Or is using.
Yeah.
So say I've got 6 horse locations, but I've only improved one. And that's the only one you know about. Well, guess what? There's exactly one in the market. And it's going to be costly.
Well, the other thing is, though, like, sometimes you want that horse more than other times. So, okay, fine. I won't build horse units then, you know? It's after the chariot archer period, and I'll have a knight you use. So, maybe I'll just go crossbows this time, rather than buying your horse for an exorbitant price. You have that kind of stuff, too. It's not that easy to do well. You can, but it's not that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I just have this convoluted thought of just like, Monty's like, hey, can I get some iron? No, I need them for my swordsman. Hey, Monty, can I get some iron? No, I need them for long swordsman. I get the tanks. Hey, can I get your iron? Yeah, sure. So you can build those units with the iron, and then after I declare war on you, you get the 50% combat penalty, number one, and then I can get, you know, some recycling credits for the iron that I take off of your dead corpses that my tanks run over.
Yeah. Totally not feasible.
I'm recycling. I'm not polluting. No.
Yeah.
That's right. You can help against the climate change. You can punish Montezuma for his poor farming practices.
I mean, we could get really dark and say, so, about the corpses and using that fertilizer.
Soylent Green is people.
You see, kids.
Yeah, at this point.
Anyways.
How do you get more coal? If you're using a coal to move a unit along the railroad, how do you get more coal? That's what comes to mind.
I assume you get your coal back when your unit gets off the railroad.
Oh, okay.
That's part of his point.
Oh, okay. Maybe I just misunderstood him in the first place. Because I remember, like, not liking the idea, and I don't have a problem with that now. So either I changed my mind in the interim, or I just didn't understand in the first place.
Yeah, he might have just been refining it, because we may not have understood it the first time.
Yeah, he might have changed what he said, too. That's possible.
That, too. Yeah.
If you want to have, like, a resource partially being used to move a unit more quickly, that's not necessarily a bad mechanic, and it does give some incentive to try and get more of that resource so you have more flexibility.
Mm-hmm. But then you might have issues with people trying to kick the unit off the railroad because, damn it, I got
to
move somebody
else. Or, like, your coal to cripple the mobility.
Yeah.
That would matter a lot more on a bigger map, incidentally, which I would like to see with 64-bit that would help a lot with one unit per hex as well. More total hexes and less crowding.
Yeah, and Mega Bears Fan had published this list September of last year, and we talked about it as part of episode 237's recording, but it was an extended conversation. So yes, Mega Bears Fan, you got a whole episode. Dang, I got a whole episode, quote-unquote. Just try not to let it go to your head. I know it's difficult once you've got Polycast fame to your name, but, you know, you try not to let it just identify you that way.
Yeah.
That's sure. Okay. That's how it works.
Recorded for episode 249, Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Mad Jin, and Lord Parkin. Episode 248 feedback from Defiant Mars. We were talking about the Wonder Compensation last episode, and, well, if you don't end up getting that Wonder of the World, then get the building equivalent of that, and then, of course, well, are there necessarily equitably for every Wonder a building that you could attach that to? To which later on in the thread, Defiant Mars is like, is this just an excuse to construct more buildings so that you can have that? And I'm like, yes. But he says, what about unique buildings? Why, many of them are similar to the buildings they replace. This could get a bit tricky. I can't give any examples, but it sets a blip on my design challenge radar because of that thing. And I just said, I would include unique buildings in my consideration of Wonder of the World equivalents. So, for example, if you're Syria and you fail to build the Great Library, then you get hammers towards your library replacement, and you would otherwise get hammers towards libraries.
No, I would agree that the UBs would work, because if you're building the Great Library, then you're going to be building it in the style of your Royal Library. It's not going to be like, well, the Great Library looked like this because the stupid Greeks built it. You're building it towards your own style.
There you go.
Defiant Mars wanted to know about, you know, the research lab segment discussing armies in particular. I'd like to do some research, but can someone explain to me how military units work in Civ 4 in terms of stacks and how unique units fit into that? I said there's a related part of that on the Civilization 4 Info Center on CFC. And I also made reference to how armies were done in Civilization Revolution. Talked about how perhaps you could have the option to, you know, to uncouple an army could be possible in certain conditions, though for like clarity of the game would have to, you know, delineate or otherwise extrapolate what that would be. So I said, for instance, if an injured unit significantly, say, any less than one unit, then an equivalent calculation would be lost. Whereas, for example, if you got the unit back up to full healing and it took 3 units to make that, then you could at some point choose to decouple them if you thought that would be a benefit to do so. And then Defiant Mars was like, so this cap on army size could be increased over time, such as technology, civilization ability, or whatever the equivalent of social policy, civic virtues will be in the next Civ. I said that, yeah, I agree with an army size limit, distinguishable from a stack of doom, where units can still share a tile but fight individually, like in this way, a la Civilization Revolution. But I also like the idea that increasing your army size cap would not just be tied to technology, that there would be other ways, and perhaps there might even be better ways than going just along and picking up this particular technology, and now you increase your army cap. And then he finally asked, would armies be more effective in particular terrains or whatever? And to me, that kind of speaks to the type of units that you would be able to combine into an army, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, could you have multiple units of the same kind, warrior, and or type, melee, of which warrior is, or at least one of a couple of different types? Do you want to have like a melee and a ranged combination of an army? And then there's pros and cons to what they can and can't do that you could then also tie to a particular terrain? That'd be neat.
Well, this reminds me very much of the Civ 3 armies, where you could just sort of combine different units in if you wanted, and that, so you got the hit points would stack up, and you move at the speed of the slowest unit in the army, and I think it was averaged with the strength of the units. Yeah, could be useful if you're still going for the one unit per tile thing. I'm not sure if they'll go with that for the next Civ game, but I guess we'll see.
Couple commentary in there. So unit cap, like army size cap, like every single space game ever. So, basically, yeah. It's already been proved out for space games, so whether or not that would be pulled in for land, which it has been pulled in for land almost every single not-Civ game, turn-based strategy-wise, sort of exists in there with that. Actually, more the fantasy ones, really. Fantasy ones tend to have unit caps for armies. But then, yeah, you could mix and match. So, say you have 3 units. So, you put a sword, spear, and ranged unit. Then you'd have higher defense because of the swords, a little bit better anti-cav or anti-flank because of the spear, so you could reduce your opponent's flanking bonus, and then you get a free strike with the bow. Or if you throw horses in there, you'd have increased flanking bonus. Or 3 melee would give you very, very solid defense and attack or whatever, depending on what you have. And then if you have mass bows, well, then they just get ran over.
That sounds solid.
But yeah, you could easily do stuff that takes into consideration what land you're on or what the combinations are. Although you could have weird stuff where you end up finding out that like people just play one type of combination because it's just more powerful than the other ones. As long as it doesn't get silly, like, by the end of the game, I have 20 units in my stack. No. It would have to be a very limited number, like 3. That's a good limited number. But even still, eh.
Wait. No, this would all be great, but still, eh?
Yeah.
What? Wait a minute. Everything I said, eh.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
Man realized he was agreeing too much with me. He had to put that.
Yeah, throw that little tiny bit in there.
The end.
Which kind of elephant is this stamping?
I was just, you know, further explaining how your concept would work and then, like, throwing it out.
Yeah, don't mind me. Just throwing it.
Recorded for episode 248 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Majin, and Mike W.
So there's a who or what am I thread going on. It's beyond 500 pages. Show results 10,001 to 10,020 of 10,359. Okay, there might have been a few posts in this one.
Yeah, there's more than 10,000 posts, and over the last 2 weeks, it's got more than 21,000 views.
Yeah.
Started in May 2013, so we're finally talking about it.
Woo!
We weren't really certain it had longevity, so we had to wait until it was like over 700,000 views till we knew it was going to stick around for a while. So,
totally. You know. That 5-star rating, nah.
Oh.
The general concept here is it's just a little game to test your knowledge of Civ. The way it got started by Ataman1, not Ottoman, because they spelled it wrong. Ataman1. Basically, you post a clue about something in Civ, not modded, no mod allowed. Post a clue, either a picture or a description or a quote from Civ 5 and any of its components, and then people guess. And, of course, it's, you know, usual guessing game and don't give it away easily, yada, yada, yada. So, for example, the very first one, clue number 1. This building needs a specific resource near the city it is being built in. People threw out guesses. They were all wrong. They were all wrong for the wrong reasons. So they thought, oh, they meant, say, the circus or the mint or a forge, which, while does require some resources near the city, the actual answer was Stoneworks, because Stoneworks actually needs that there near the city or not. Or maybe it was just a bad clue. So it keeps going, and then the person who guessed right gets to pick the next one.
Part of the rules is if there are 5 incorrect guesses, then you're supposed to give another clue.
Yep.
And that very first clue, that opened up a number of possible suggestions. So you know what it is that you want to find, but you're not certain where it is, so you're just kind of throwing a dart at a board and hoping you hit it correctly in the absence of anything else.
And, of course, don't throw multiple answers up and hope that one of them is right.
Yeah, you're supposed to wait at least 12 hours before posting another guess, unless there's a new clue.
Yeah, you just can't spam.
I enjoyed the comment, under rules, even though it is not a rule, this game is intended to be fun, so do not rage quit or anything like that. There's no reward out of this.
but Kuwaki was getting cookies. There's points and cookies.
Yep, he's in first place right now.
Cookie?
Oh, magic words from Mackie. He was guest on my guest 59.
You need to be careful, Mackie. Internet cookies aren't always so tasty.
Yeah, true. They can do funny things to your browser.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the thread starter himself is in second with 24 points, and CPM 4001 is in third with 21.
And considering how long the game's been going?
Yeah.
It's weird that the points are so low.
It's almost like the points don't matter. Oh.
Or the person who started the thread got bored a long time ago. No, the last edit was February 6th, so today. By today, I mean the day that we're actually recording this, not the day you'll actually hear this.
It may or may not be true at that stage.
Polycast guests are actually in the top 20. Magma Dragoon is in 10th, so is Reddish Recue, Stormtrooper 412, Sedwick, Teprock.
Mm. Some people just aren't even on the list. Some people got cookies without getting points. How'd that work out?
Maybe they made, like, good guesses and they wanted to be rewarded.
Or maybe they just made so many guesses but haven't found the answer. They're like, okay, here's a cookie. You play.
Yeah. What, so the cookie's like your participation certificate?
Yeah.
Thanks for me.
Well, that devalues the cookies, I tell you what.
Yeah.
That's not good.
Well, nothing in the rules but says when you would get a cookie. There's none.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe those are the oatmeal cookies.
Mmm. Gluten-free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ugh.
Don't rage quit the show, Mackie, just to film it.
So is it gluten-free? Ah!
Eight-bit Civilization. Playing Civilization on a Commodore 64. There is a YouTube video with just over 11,000 views and richly published on February 13th, and then discussed over on the 1164.com forums. He shows you what he has put into it. It's based on the original Civilization and is looking forward to continuing the development of this. He's hoping to finish it by the end of the year if time allows, but he lists that there are a number of things that have to be put into the game still, but he only has 2.5 kilobytes left of memory. So he's hoping that he's going to be able to find some optimization in the code otherwise, so he doesn't have to say, well, I'm only going to have just one of these additional things to try to have it to be as in a complete state as possible. But a recurring thing that came up on the 1164.com forum was, how did you keep this under the radar for so long? He didn't talk about it publicly until this point in time. That's a very effective strategy of keeping things under the radar, not talking about it publicly. I just pro tip.
If you want something kept really? Secret, you should first keep it yourself, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. That wasn't the proper introduction. You see, kids, there is this thing called a Commodore 64.
Mm.
And
yeah, I'm just looking through the YouTube video. The for the platform we're talking about here, it actually looks pretty nice.
It is impressive.
Yeah. It's not an achievement, but should be.
Right.
So, Fondocide started this thread, and I think it's actually pretty good because looking at some of these achievements that people have come up with, those could actually be real achievements in game, like actual achievable things that are not quite easy to do, but would be useful or good.
Well, you know what one of Dan's favorites is going to be? Shaka Hulu?
Some of them are just silly, but a lot of them really do fall within the range of what we have already in terms of achievements.
Yep. So he starts out with, hold the spice, please. Play as Indonesian. Do not settle any cities on another continent. And of course, he says that one's out of sheer frustration. That just happens. In a close second, Shaka Hulu. So declare war on Shaka the same turn you meet his forward settling psychopathic little self.
I love that description of Shaka.
Cross-reference to Monty.
Yep.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah, something like that for Monty as well.
But then we get some really cool stuff, like from Gutsu. It is better to be feared than loved. Have every single AI either guarded or afraid, with no less than half of the other civilizations being afraid. See, that would be a good achievement.
It's well-named, too. I like that.
Yeah.
The Wolfpack one in the same post isn't bad either.
Yeah, reference.
Yeah, playing as any civ, sink 10 units with submarines in 3 turns or less.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Elite Force, have your starting warrior survive until the end of the game and obtain every possible promotion. Yep.
Some people have actually already done that, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it's just as important to give a good name for your achievement as well as having the achievement being good as well.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Totally. The Hokey Pokey, capture, lose, and recapture the same city in 3 consecutive turns.
I think we've had this happen in multiplayer.
Yeah.
Or as an alternate, capture, lose, and recapture the same civilian unit in 3 consecutive turns.
And, of course, good old days, destroy a tank with a spearman.
Yeah.
I really like the idea. I can't believe that worked in defeat a German armored unit with a Polish mounted unit. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Oh, I want Samba Jerome. Brazil has 7 great works of music in Rio.
Yep. Haremroot, win the game as Austria after joining by marriage at least 12 city-states. I'll make you an offer that you can't refuse. In the course of a game, gain at least 20 puppets without ever conquering any city.
And they said it was impossible. Have Krakatoa within your city's working range.
Yep, that one should be there.
It does happen, but not very often.
I didn't mean to, I swear.
Esper, peekaboo, recall a civ to life and then exterminate them again in the same
turn. Oh, that's just cold.
Declare war on a country to declaration of friendship with by hitting one of the units with a nuke as collateral. It was an accident. That's happened in our multiplayer games, too.
Yep. Poland cannot enter space, dropping a tank bomb or a nuclear missile on the Polish capital when it needs only one more part of the spaceship.
Oh, yeah.
Nope, screw you.
Was it something I said? Be at war simultaneously with every original civ on a standard, the larger map, and survive 10 turns.
Oh, death and taxes being so much debt that a unit disbands. Oh, well.
It's a good name for the achievement, too.
Yeah, it is.
Yep. Eye for an eye, steal the tech from a player who stole the tech from you less than 10 turns let go.
I'd bet to a little bit of that in our turn cast as well. Because like, we have an agreement that neither of us built anti-spy buildings, and then we're effectively tech trading. It's kind of broken. It's really unnecessary to win, too, but it's fun.
I think an alternate title for that one could be What Goes Around Comes Around.
Yeah.
Yep.
This one was from the thread starter. Not your turn. Have an opponent get an ancient ruin with your unit. One title.
Speaking of things that have happened in multiplayer.
No.
Yep.
I saw two more on here that I liked in particular, and I was actually mostly sticking with those that applied to playing as any civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Oops. Lose your starting settler.
Well, yeah.
Yep.
It happened.
But the last one is just like, no, of course Dan chose this one. Kick them when they're down. Bully a city state that has already been bullied by somebody else.
Dan.
Excellent. Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month to month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
I avoided myself from saying something really inappropriately there.
Heyo.
Speaking of inappropriate, it's time to end the show.
Oh, it's true. It's never appropriate to end the show, but it has to end all the same. Thank you for joining us on Polycast episode 250. I am the Mean Team. As usual, I am joined by regular co-hosts Dan Q.
That moment when you realize that Sid spelled backwards is dis.
Ma Kalua.
I'm not sure what logic Dan operates on, but that was weird.
Imagine.
Time for a good nap.
And guest co-host CPM4001.
I can't think of a good thing to say to close out of the show, so, yeah.
Perfect.
Thanks for having me.
Wait, you don't think a good thing to say from closing out the show would be to say thanks for having me? You think that's a bad thing to say?
Sounds like
Dan, quit lawyering.
Nothing really brilliant, you know?
Quit lawyering? Hey, I resemble that remark.
Hey, you can help me get the surprise domination victory on Dan.
Mm.
Surprise, huh?
Yes.
You just told me you're going to go for a domination victory?
Yeah.
Oh, on the final turn, the XCOMs just land everywhere.
Well,
you know, you can define victory however you want. Sid has given us permission now.
Yeah.
So,
that's true.
You know.
It's all there.
Yeah.
Recording live the Sester Centennium episode of Polycrap, or Polycast.
can't speak, you know?
Bigger is better, and if you want to play a city-state, you can, but don't whine to us, because 4X, and there's 4Xs, and you're not meant to delete one of those.
I hope so. I hope Civ 4 gets rid of the cancer that is tall versus wide, as it is represented in 5.
Civ 4's already come out.
That's what I thought.
Okay, it's still trolling us again.
Yes,
this was happening.
I think it is. Yes, can't wait for Civ 3, man. It's so much better.
Send to your mom. Okay, no.
Why would you send hate mail to your own mom, Dan? Jeez.
Seriously.
No, I said I was sending it to your mom.
Joke's on you, she never sent her email.
But you do acknowledge she has an email address. Okay, good to know.
Yeah, and it's not mackiesmom@gmail.com.
How awesome would it be, though?
No, that was already taken, so it's mackiesmom17439@gmail.com. Fact.
Of course, yeah.
No.
Record date?
March 5th, 2016.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.